play a guy who is again Secret Service. Mm-hmm. He lives on the border from Afghanistan to Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows where he's from. Everybody knows that he works with everybody, but they leave him alone. He's like a double agent for everybody. Yeah. And but he has this unofficial status that nobody really bothers him. The Americans ask him. The ex-Afghan government, which is in exile in Pakistan, works with him. The Taliban know that, but they work with him. It's interesting character. It was shot in Bulgaria. There's places that look like Afghanistan. And there were things a lot that showed the border. It would take forever to find the pictures, but yeah.
Welcome back to season 3 of Fractured Podcast, a very informative podcast where we give you many information about so-called refugee crisis, all the things that are happening in relation to movement of people, and we're bringing also good practices, how we can actually tackle many issues here. And in episode 1, we were talking more about Mahsa Amini protest. We want to stay with Iran, as so many members of Refocus Media Labs community are Iranians. We're going to go slightly different path today. However, we still have stars of the Tehran series with us. And today, to join me and Rashid, is Vasilis Koukalanis. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Welcome. Nice to see you again.
It's a privilege. Thank you very much.
Vasilis is an actor, obviously. He's a theater director as well. But again, we're having here mostly because of his engagement in the protest movement and in supporting of changes in Iran, here from Greece, because Vasilis is a Greek-Iranian. Also, I spent a lot of time in Germany, which I hope we will talk more about. But what we would actually like to start with is actually the situation that is happening right now in Iran and the protests. So the protests to commemorate Mahsa Amini's death are one thing, but they are not only about that, right? We are very much concerned in the film community about what is happening with people who are making movies, who are playing in movies. We had those big arrests of famous directors who were awarded Golden Bears. So Cannes Film Festival is making quite a lot of noise about releasing them. Can you tell us a little bit about what is happening in this area? Because this is your area, your community.
Okay. Well, it's an ongoing thing over the last 25 years that I hear again and again. I don't know. Right now, I really don't know the details. I mean, there's many directors in Iran who are in and out of jail or house arrest again and again, but still their films are being made in some way. Still, they are in the public dispute over and over again. And the government in Iran has many, many reasons to, you know, incarcerate and take the freedom of artists who have over the years managed to make a voice for themselves that can speak up and be heard, you know, all over the globe. I'm sure, except the famous artists who are, you know, being heard all over the world that, you know, are being prosecuted or whatever, there must be many, many artists in Iran who are being censored, who are being prosecuted, who are not allowed to work, or their work is being discriminated or forbidden, or whatever. And, you know, in some way, there's always, all over the world, there is, you know, artists who have something to say that is maybe not mainstream, that is too maybe profound for what the artistic community or the status quo of the arts can handle. And they're also sometimes being sidekicked or put aside, you know.
But maybe not to this point as in Iran, because no, Jafar Panahi, right, one of those like big names, he is in prison right now. But before that, he was also sentenced to 20 years of ban on making movies. So a filmmaker was banned from making movies. He actually, I read that he actually made, this was in 2010, so it's already 13 years since that happened. He made some movies with his cell phone, mostly of himself.
In his house.
And they were actually pretty good movies that went international.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the typical things that made the Iranian, you know, modern cinema very popular in Europe and also in Greece, especially in the 90s when it started, this wave, was exactly that you could recognize artists who have their possibilities to talk are very contained, are very difficult. They are under censorship, they are under surveillance, but still it's the ways they have chosen to express things that are forbidden are that more synthetic. Complex, are that more poetic, but just in order to say something. I mean, and that can make art very, very powerful, you know, to find ways to say something important for you, to find collective ways also to say something that is important to you. If art has nothing to say but just something to present, it is worthless anyway. You can read it when you see some artist who just wants to be an artist and is not driven by something very, very important to share, then usually the art is also, you know, very predictable, very very soft, not strong enough. And that was born in Iran, and those films had that, you know, made a name for themselves all over the world, especially I think Europe at that time, that they could not be denied to make more films, and they could be more and more also provocative, you know, like the artists made way for others to come and speak and show them the ways. And I think I find that very, very exciting, you know. It's, you know, may you live in exciting times. Well, the times you are made exciting by how you see them, you know, how you make those times, you know. So, yeah, I think the Iranian cinema has that way and that privilege, gained that privilege. Now with Panahi, you know, it's amazing that he's been, you know, under surveillance and he's been, you know, incarcerated and in and out of his house or prison for 20 years, but still he keeps making his films all the time. Exciting films, good stuff, but he's managed to be present. Mm-hmm. And that is also, yeah.
Of huge value.
Yes.
Yeah. So if, like, for example, I was in Iran, now Iranian, and I'm a filmmaker, stand-up comedian, so what are the lines that I shouldn't cross? And if I ever been crazy enough to cross them, what will happen to me right now?
In Iran? I suppose if you say something that is subversive, you will go to prison, I think. Okay. You will be prosecuted.
So anything against them is out of the question.
You can be a student and write something in the university when you give an exam, and if that is provocative, if that is subversive, if that is against the government, they may come and pick you up. That's what makes that's what makes Iran a dictatorship, or even a police dictatorship. That, you know, there is one party that rules, or two parts of one party that rules, and if you say something against that system, the so-called Islamic Republic, then you are an enemy of the state. Then you are, and that's interesting. You know, when right after the revolution, you were just a counter-revolutionary, but later you are just someone who, you know, who doesn't believe. How do you say you're a heathen, or you are an enemy of the state? You are. Anyway, the words in English don't pop up that easily right now. So yeah, that's what makes it a dictatorship. If you say something against them, then they probably first will put you in jail, or maybe, you know, ban you from working, and then you probably will have to leave.
Wow.
Well, knowing Rashid's stand-up, and not many people know that he is a stand-up comedian, I know several. I've listened and seen several of his stand-up comedies. I'm pretty sure he would end up in prison very, very fast. They're
executed,
very inappropriate.
Yeah. Execute,
you're definitely executing your right to freedom of speech. Vasilis, you mentioned so many artists who are not those big names are in prison as well, and they do not get all this echo from outside, from those big filmmaking communities, right? So why is the regime so much afraid of those artists? And if they are not even big names, right, why are so many of them in prison? Why are there so many in house arrests? And we're not talking only about those light censorship here, right? The penal code in Iran is really harsh. I Google translated for myself, and it was really, really disturbing. I'm not saying that people who express their artistic freedoms are being punished this way, but it was really absolutely terrifying to see that things like whipping, like blinding people, stoning, crucifying, amputations, like that is still a thing in Iran, right? So it is very terrifying for me to think that somebody goes to prison and potentially can be sentenced to something like this. How are those artists actually playing a role in this revolution, in this movement?
Well, I think, I think a lot of ruling systems, a lot of governments, a lot of dictatorships are always afraid of artists, because art in times like this has the power to emancipate people, has the power to open people's eyes, has the power to give them hope, to rise. But I think a big part is emancipation, and that is what is also in difficult times in dictatorships chosen the arts. I mean, the most exciting forms of art have come out of difficult situation, because there was the need to tell the truth, to emancipate people, to show what is going on from a very certain perspective, which is always the perspective of your viewers, the people, the working class, the children, the young people. If you see the things, you know, it's very Brechtian, like Brecht, you know, you show the world as it is from a certain point of view, have a critical view on it, and then you show the perspective of change. You show the perspective of how that can change. You show the potential that it can change. And in the end also, you try to give the hope or the power to empower for that to happen. And for example, also in Greece, the greatest musicians who were all over the world were the ones who combined, you know, very, very high musical taste with the popular understanding of music. That was the most powerful way to speak about the military dictatorship here, about what is going on in the world, you know, from here to Vietnam to wherever. So that was an art that was very strong because it combined art, which for many governments or for many ruling systems is viewed as something very high class or bourgeois or something that is a privilege. And it's not that. It is born out of, you know, the common life of the people. It's grassroots, exactly. So when it represents that, it can become very, very strong and also write history, actually. And I think they're afraid of that in Iran. Iran only as an example. We have many, many duplicates of that example if you look around. When does art become dangerous? And a question also that... we should ask ourselves as artists, and I mean as a collective of artists, of all of us, is, you know, how do we become disturbing for what is going on? How can we become dangerous? How can we make the ruling press say, who are these people who are questioning our ways or are poisoning the minds of our youth? Exactly what is being said in Iran. You know, they are poisoning the minds, the brains of our young people or something. So it's a very good and very pregnant question of how do we provoke things? How do we provoke or become provocative with our views so we open spaces where we can discuss, you know, where we can come into discussion with the other side or whatever. I think that is what they are afraid of. That is why art is being all over the world now, being very, very commercialized, very ephemeral. How do you say ephemeral? Very short-lived. I think that is something that has happened to art and has made it a little bit, it's being made a little bit powerless, you know, sometimes. So, yeah, I believe in the art that provokes, that comes out and disturbs and provokes.
When was the last time you were in Iran? And are you safe as an artist here? And you said provoking. So you are provoking as an artist. So are you safe like this? Can you go back?
Well, in Iran, I went back in 2009. That was many, many years after we had left. We had left in close to 81, just when the war started in Iraq, with Iraq. And I had gone back when I could go for a month or two without being taken to the army. So it wasn't something political because I was a child when I left and my father had gone before, sometime in the end of the 90s. So 2009 I went and it was a week before the elections, which was, the elections that gave Ahmadinejad his second term, but it was so, you know, obvious that they made, that it was... you say the election was rigged. And then it came the uprising, the green movement for the two following months. And I stayed in total, I stayed for like 7 weeks. I was there more than 1.5 months. I traveled all around and I lived, you know, the week up to the elections, which actually showed that Mousavi is probably going to win like Khatami used to win with 80%. I mean, it was obvious. There was not young one. I mean, especially in the cities. I had seen before the election three cities: Tehran, Shiraz, and Isfahan. We had visited them, and everywhere there was a party going on with about the election. So when the election were rigged, I really got scared. But you could feel that, and I think I carried that also since I was a child because I had lived these things there. It became suddenly dangerous. It became serious, and I felt it. Me, my father, and my uncle, we had just traveled towards the Azerbaijan part of Iran, and when we heard that Ahmadinejad won with 63%, it was like, oh, the fear that something bigger than us is at work here, you know. And because Hitler used to say, the bigger the lie, the more people are going to believe it because they will fear, you know. So it felt like that. But then the Green Movement, you know, went forth. I mean, was born and went forth. And those were exciting times again. But since then, I didn't go. You know, also since I wouldn't take the risk. I've done some things even before, you know, Tehran that could, you know, might get me into trouble. Also, my activity here in Greece. I mean, the consulate, whatever, the embassy here. I think they know everything that everybody does here. I realized that back then. Yeah. I mean, even when I had not worked very much in 2009, they knew exactly what I had done in the theater, in television, or whatever, which was not much back then. So. Yeah, I wouldn't take the risk to go.
Maybe we just clarify that in Iran, every male has to serve in the army normally, and you were able to go back because the law changed at that time, right? And you had a double passport.
No, not double passport. They allowed people who, you know, grew up abroad to come to Iran for 2 or 3 months a year without being taken to the military of a certain age and after. So I was just 40 then, or no, after 38, whatever, I was 38 back then, that they could come for 3 months a year, you know, without being taken, drafted to the army.
Mm-hmm. So if you stayed 4 months and you're leaving, they can catch you in the airport and take you.
Perhaps. I think it's more, like in Greece also they had that in the 90s, it came, you know, because many went and because they didn't serve, they could only come for a month or two. If you come and live here and get taxed here and your life is here, then you have to go and do your service. That's just silly stuff. So, yeah.
So if we could go back in time and what could we have done to prevent the Islamic from taking over? And I don't know if you know about Algeria. I grew up there. I was born there. 1991, the Islamic took over, but the army came and said, no, we don't want a second Iran. But that led to 10 years of blood. So what could have been done to prevent the Algerian example and the situation right now?
Well, about Iran, the Algerian example, I mean, all the times in the beginning of the... Also... Well, the Algeria example, I think, is a bit different. Yeah. I think that has more Western involvement and everything, like also the later Arab Spring has a lot of Western involvement and things being tested there. Whatever, I think I wouldn't go into details because I'm also not very expert on that. You know, you can get easily confused. You know, between Egypt, Sudan, Tunisia, and Libya, and what was going on there. So I would stay with Iran. I think that the fact that it fell into the hands, that Iran fell into the hands of the Islamic Republic, the Islamic governing, you know, brought on the biggest bloodshed ever. A whole generation was, killed with the war and with the executions and with the prosecutions and with the people who went abroad. It's funny because one of the facts about Iran that is, you know, over the last 25 years is being said again and again is that 70% of Iranian population is until 35, or now 45, because they were all born after the revolution. I always tell that to friends of mine when we talk about, revolution and eroticism, for example. I say, you know, the revolution is always sexy times. It is the example of Iran shows it. You know, 70% of the Iranian population now was born during the revolution and the year after the revolution. Of course, it played a big role that, you know, the people then, you know, we had the war, 1 to 2 million almost were killed. So there's like a big part of that middle generation was, killed. And many, you know, with the prisons and the prosecutions were also, you know, executed and killed and you know, took refuge elsewhere. So, you know, I think it's a big tragedy that it fell in those hands. I think in Iran, because it looked like a very strong, that this revolution came from many sides and was very based in political thinking and dialogue of what we call the democratic and over parts, left and everything. It was rooted in ideologies. In Iran is, when they say the miracle of the desert, it was very Western in its involvement and its political thinking. It was, you know, very much in front. So I think if actually the revolution in 79 had fallen to the hands of good, you know, democratic progressive people, if Iran had become a modern democracy with, of course, you know, the specialties or the details of that region, you know, I think the Americans would have lost all the Middle East, I suppose. And I think, you know, no offense to anybody, but I think that played a role, maybe. I think, you know, the center of the Near and Middle East, which is Iran, it would have spread over. It would have been, I don't know. I have, you know, the memory of the history is something that continues growing into all dimensions as you grow up, as you read things again, as you go over the things again, when you talk with people. So, you know, what I think is that if Iran had really, really fallen into something that would be progressive, we would have gone into something that made the Americans make in 53 the putsch, the coup d'etat against Mossadegh, you know, and made then came a 30-year military dictatorship. I think it would have gone that way. I think the ruling West or the over-Atlantic West would have lost its power in a very big part of the Middle East. I don't know. Anyway, you know, I cannot be sure about that, but you know, it was a very big tragedy. It affected my family very strongly. What happened after the revolution? The revolution itself was something really exciting and glorious, and gave this perspective of something is changing. I mean, the world is changing, because people then, you know, my parents, that generation, they didn't want to fix their lives. You know, they wanted to change the world. You know. And that is, I think, good and profound and exciting. So it was a glorious time that actually, became a very, very big tragedy. I mean, me and my mother left, and almost a year later, my father had to hide in Iran for another 6 months until he made it over Kurdistan into Turkey and escaped. You know, many of our friends were caught and executed. Mm-hmm. Mm.
Is this how you ended up in Germany?
No, this is how we came here. We started in Germany, or my life started in Germany, and then we went to Iran. My father went first, and then we went after. And when we left, just before, you know, the war, in the middle of the after-revolutionary times, you know, when actually it became a dictatorship, very, very obviously, very dark, that's when we left, me and my mother first. But we came to Athens, not back to Germany. We came to Greece. So, yeah, it affected my family in many, many ways, those times.
Thank you for sharing. We're going to take a short break,
yeah.
Okay. And we will be right back. I'm Sonia.
And I'm Doug.
And we're the founders of Refocus Media Labs. Our foundation was created in 2018 to give refugees modern media skills so badly needed in places like this, Lesbos, Greece. We created a studio here on Lesbos, And we are trying to teach people photography, video editing, graphic design, filmmaking, to allow them to enter job markets here in Europe, but also to give them a platform to showcase their work.
My name is Yasser. I've started to join Refocus in 2019.
We were students. We had no idea that we are going to be a citizen journalist one day. We were just coming to classes to learn new skills, just like the new students right now. And we were interested and motivated by taking photos every day, having a camera in our hands, and doing something that normally a person couldn't do in the island.
One, two, three.
What Refocus is doing is serving and teaching students every day, two shifts, and what they're teaching, photography, videography, it's the skill that they can improve and over time in the future use it to have a job.
And her eyes, her face is red on that PowerPoint.
The goal here is that this is the start of a career, or this is at least the start of a chance for them to have an equitable future.
The beautiful thing that's happening is that our most advanced students are some of our teachers. And they are showing to the new student, who is them just a year ago, that this is possible and that this is something that they can push for.
It's so crucial, so critical to give those skills and those tools to refugees here to make sure that they are creative, that they are artists, that they are journalists, that they are something more than being just a refugee, this label that the whole world puts on them.
What makes me different is that I am able to share my voice with the media, with the skills I've learned. Whenever somebody take a look at our news, they feel it. They feel that they are in the situation.
Vasilis, I want to go back to the protests that are happening in Iran right now. In your opinion, do they stand any chance of becoming something bigger, something more sustainable? It doesn't look like they have one clear leader. We spoke a little bit with Ellie about how women play a really big role in those protests, but they do not have this leader. They do not seem to have a very well structured. You can correct me, of course, if I'm wrong. But do you think they stand any chance of becoming something more and actually changing the system? And if so, what would it change it into?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's a very political question, you know, to depict what actually this uprising was. I have the experience of the Green Movement, where me experiencing that, I already my thoughts were around what is so different from the 79. I was 89 years old back then when the revolution started. And most of it, I was in Iran. My parents stayed over it. And I went right after the revolution back to Iran, the summer after. I think what I saw in the Green Movement was that after this rigged election, the young people who went on the street, it was like history imitating itself. Some of the songs that were back in the end of 70s after in the revolution came back. Some of the activities, you know, the people take up came back, and mostly it looked like it. I don't know any revolution that brought down whole empire, so to speak, mm-hmm. as the Shah's was, you know, and rooted also in the West very strongly by millions of people in the streets, because that's what happened in 79. You know, the revolution, it was, I think, very singular in its way, in its history, in that part of the world also. It was millions of people day in, day out on the streets, you know, and all kinds also. You know, you could see there were blocks of women who were wearing all chador, and right after there were blocks of women who were not wearing chador, or there were blocks of where men and women were mixed. And there were blocks of demonstrations that were only men, for example, which was the, you know, the outskirts of Tehran or the bazaaris, which were close to the Islamic way of thinking. In all, though, the breath you could take from that is that there is something really profoundly changing here. They want to change the world. They want to change what is going on, the system itself. And they are questioning what is going on deeply and very politically. And it also had, it was very, very civilized. I will never forget during those marches, those big marches. I mean, imagine a march that starts in Omonia and goes all the way to Kivisya. Mm-hmm. One march. That
and it's diverse, like a lot of people.
Diverse, yeah. But also huge. You know, 3 million people. I mean, imagine that. Here we are happy if on the 1st of May or during the Politecnio, we say, oh, today we were 110,000. That's great. And we are very happy about it. There it was not ever under 2 million. And they brought down this emperor. It was also, I have this remembrance of something very civilized, which was depicting how we imagine, you know, the change, whatever. I will never forget that. And whoever I tell the story, they are very amazed. I remember when those long marches of people, suddenly the whole, because the Iranians are very strong in saying paroles, you know, very, very strong in saying paroles, and they can say it 25 times. I remember also them during Mahsa Amini, they would say each parole, here that you say 2.5 to 3 times the paroles. Yeah. They would say 10, 15 times, you know, also here, you know.
I actually heard Ellie chanting also at the anniversary of the Russian invasion on Ukraine. She was the one chanting the longest.
And everybody else, okay, yes. Okay, cool down. But anyway, what was happening suddenly, the whole, very large part of the demonstration would stop shouting, be quiet. And I remember asking my father, what is going on? And the crowd was just passing a hospital. I mean, the people from the hospital, they were on their balconies looking down at the people that were going by and saying hello. But it is a hospital. There are sick people there. You have to be quiet. In the hospital, you are quiet. I will never forget that. That looks like a very, you know, also political, also humanitarian, and also very, very deeply civilized way of being, of thinking, of approaching the things. I will never forget that. Now, what I experienced in 2009 is that we are talking about a class of people, especially the young people, that what they know mostly is that they are sick of what is going on to them over the last 35 years. And the only thing they actually know is that they want to get rid of that. So I cannot be very sure of what the social dream behind that is, you know. We only know we don't want this, but how have we imagined, you know, politically, socially, in all ways, what we want to build, you know. It's like I always have this feeling, and I get very, very epiphylacticos. I have my second thoughts when I see that is, are they even ready for, you know, for the Americans to come in and you know, bring the pop culture, Madonna, whatever, come. Anything better than those people. Mm-hmm. So that's when I say there is an absence of a social vision, mm-hmm. not dream, vision. That's what I felt, you know. You expressed that before in your question as there is no leadership of that. Mm-hmm. And I would go further and say that, I don't know if it's the absence of the leader, it is the absence of political understanding, of a common political understanding. Where do we want to go from here? That was very present in the end 70s. Now it isn't. Now with Mahsa Amini, which is, you know, again, we are more than 10 years later, this uprising, I mean, it was very spontaneous. It started from nothing. I mean, Mahsa Amini, these things happen in Iran, I mean, all over Iran, at least once a month. Mm-hmm. But that was the moment where the power made the little big mistake. and it exploded. Now, that, I think, is a little more than the green movement, because when it lasted, you know, when it became strong, people started get killed. People would not go pull back, and it was then it became more and more political because of the strikes, and there were huge, massive strikes. They didn't last because then, you know, political influences. I think, I don't know the details exactly what happened all over this vast country, but the thing that it came with strikes gave it a political discussion, you know. And I think those were influenced in some way politically, so, you know, people after a while, they get tired. People after a while get scared. People after a while start counting their wounds. And it sort of, you know, fell back. That is my, you know, overall impression of the Mahsa Amini uprising. You know, it gave hope. It is done. It is made in history, and it will be a point to look to fall back onto for the next uprisings. I hope these bastards will leave through an uprising, through a very, you know, powerful, violent uprising that will make them aside. What I'm afraid of is that, or what I think is that, what might happen is, we talk about Islamic Republic and everything. It has nothing anymore to do with Islamic Republic. Mm-hmm. It has to do with the military, industrial, capitalist complex in there. They want to keep the power. I mean, they have so much oil that you know, you can steal oil from Iran and they wouldn't care. They say under the Gulf that Oman and everything, they are stealing oil, and they don't even care, because Iran has a lot of power in that, and gas and all that. They have, it's very rich. And I think they want to hold on to the power. So what might happen is that it will be a little and step by step going over to a more, you know, a democratic system as we know it, little by little. And when these things happen, usually the people who were ruling before rule also after. I mean, history has shown us that many times. That is why I always believe more in an uprising by the people who will change things, at least in a radical way. That's what I believe.
And now some countries are trying to help this movement, and some of them like Israel. So last week, the Israeli intelligence met with the Iranian opposition groups in London. So they want to have a hand in this movement. How does the Iranian street feel about this?
I hope they are very skeptical about it. Okay. I hope, you know, I mean, whoever wants, you know, to collaborate with this special government of Israel, at least the best thing you can say about them is that it's opportunistic, that it is, you know, it has political ambitions that have nothing to do with a real change, you know. I mean, if you are the opposition and you meet with the secret service of Israel, that we know what crimes they've committed, you know, same as the CIA, same as the KGB before, or whatever they are doing, you know, all these, this circus of you know, secret service, it at least mistrust you can have. You know, it's only political ambition if you do that. You know, it has nothing to do with the street, with the young people of Iran, with the students of Iran, with the women of Iran. In reality, you know, I have nothing against Israel as it is, but I have something against the governments that are being elected that have this Zionist agenda, which thinks that, you know, that part of the world belongs to them, and you know, they can, you know, especially what happened with the Palestinians and what is happening, that they are entitled to do that. And that is, you know, if we talk about war crimes, if we talk about crimes against humanity, the biggest example has been the killing of the Jews, you know, the systematic murdering of the Jews in the Second World War. But, you know, in many ways, it is continuing to happen. I think Woody Allen says it very nice in a film of his where they are talking, I cannot see anymore these long discussions on television where they say, but how could this have happened, you know, that 6 million have died, that they killed 6 million, nothing happened. And Woody Allen says, nobody can really answer that question of all these idiots that are talking on TV because it's the wrong question. Yeah. The right question is, why doesn't it happen all the time, which it is. But in different climaxes and forms, perhaps. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I was in a film that was talking about this circus of the Secret Service everywhere. And there is proof. There are stories that, you know, in the southern parts of Afghanistan, you know, where all the Secret Service was gathered together, there is stories of collaboration between Iran and Israel against the Taliban. There are stories of the Americans with the Taliban against Iran. I mean, it was written in a scenario, or it was in the
script
in the board. No, in the board that is the about, you know, what you read alongside. You know, everybody works with everybody.
Yeah.
You know, which. Also, as you know, so the globalization of everything that is evil. You know, the markets can be globalized. The war industry can be globalized. Everything can be globalized except us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every one of us should have the right to seek asylum wherever they want to go. You know, if it has a war or not a war. If it is, you know, because if you live in a place where you are being prosecuted for your ideas, and that's how it used to be when I was younger, when I was a kid in the 70s and in the 80s, still it was like that, sort of, you have the right to seek asylum somewhere else and be respected for that, especially, you know, in the Western democratic, there's the camera, democratic ways. So yeah, I think the main difference is what I tried to point out.
You're bringing us actually very nicely to my next question, which is about the refugees here, the Iranian refugees here in Greece. The Westerners, many of them, they do not believe that if you do not come from a country that is in active state of war, or which is also very much reported in the news. So people are really bombed with those images that something is really bad happening there. Those people do not deserve asylum, or even people do not understand why would people, for example, from Iran, claim asylum if there's really no act of war. There is the same thing about Afghans. There's no war anymore. Like, why would they come? Would you lay some arguments for us here?
Well, the West is very known for its hypocritical way of treating everything to its own good. Who is the West to tell us, you know, where the wars are? You know, what qualifies as war? There's so many wars all the time that we don't really even know about. I remember when Putin started bombing the Ukraine, and especially the Germans and the Western Europeans said, "Oh, there is war in Europe or whatever, and it's the only war." And then, you know, 3 days later, there was a journalist collective that came out with a map that on those days, there were bombing going on all over the globe in Yemen, in I don't know, Sudan probably. There's wars everywhere. The tragic thing is, and everybody knows it, you know, that historically and even now there is always an involvement of the West. You know, sorry, I don't do it on purpose, but it's there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, who is really the West who tells us what qualifies as a war zone, you know? Who are they to be the referees of all the wars in the world that we ourselves, as you know, people who live in the West, have maybe brought on or profited from? You know, there are these stories when we talk about the ethical universe, the moral universe of the Western world, is that, you know, during the Iran-Iraq war, an 8-year war that killed 2 million people and was for actually really nothing, brought on nothing, changed nothing, the whole world was selling arms to both sides.
Yeah.
You know, and there is this story about, you know, this German Swiss arms company, and they were selling these chemical weapons to Iraq, and they were selling the masks for that special chemical warfare to Iran. That is, I think, very typical. That is how the what we call, you know, the
good business.
The good business. That the good business makes this morally can make this morally correct. You know, if it is market valued and it brings on something, then it is, and it is free choice and everything, then it's good. Yeah, but you are selling, you know, things that kill little kids, you know, and on the other side, you have another consumers of death that you give them a little protection over what the other, you know, death machine that you've created. And that's just nuts. And I think that is very, very typical of what we call, what I said before, the moral universe of the business West, the military industrial thing. I don't know if things are becoming here a little too radical, but, you know, it's like it's repeating itself all the time. You know, what we see. You know, there was a time in the 80s when everyone who came to Greece, which was not a very refuge, not many refugees came here, you could go elsewhere. Everybody used to say, then I'm Palestinian, because Palestinians were allowed to get all over to get asylum. A little later, everybody was Iraqi.
Yeah.
Later, everybody was Syrian. You know, we lost our papers, I'm Syrian.
And yeah.
Especially here, you know, they have to believe you, whatever. They will not bring you to test you if you are, or make a DNA, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a way of resisting that system that wants to throw people out or collect or select people of, you know, if they are entitled to the freedom that we can provide them, you know, the good life that we can provide them, you know. You know, in 2015, after the big refugee crisis in the Aegean again, after some, you know, there was this long summer of the 2015 where the Aylan story and everything, where people drowned every day in the Aegean. And Greece filled with a lot of people that were saved and everything. And then the borders opened. Mm-hmm. Remember those scenes where the refugees would arrive in Germany and people would come and say...
welcome.
Yeah, welcome and do these things. Well, what Germany back then did, it selected, it was a good chance, mm-hmm. you know, for the population to grow, to get working power from the Syrians, because the Syrians are... they just had, you know, the war was 3 years old back then, 3-4 years old. They are coming from a relatively good society. They were working people. They had education. Yeah. They had everything. So, you know, this selecting people of to what their value is, you know, for your production line, I think it's so barbaric and inhumane. You know, the Afghans, they have war for 60 years. They have not gone to school, they cannot speak other languages, they don't know, have any skills. Mm. Let them die over there. Okay. And that, you know, kind of makes you crazy, makes you sick when you think that that is, you know. I think in general, what can answer to racism and you know, this selection and everything is that to think, you know, we are one class of people, we have the same aspirations, we have the same dreams. We want to be free. We want to live our lives, you know, equally, and to be able to do what we want to do. And we are entitled to do that everywhere. If we would take power in our collective hands, then this is how it would be, you know. And that has a strength, that has a vision that I believe in. Mm-hmm. Even if we don't see it in practice, really, ever, I think that was we should think, follow, you know, mm-hmm. that we have the potential, the power to do that, the vision to do that.
Mm-hmm. And like in Greece, there is a lot of refugees here from Iran, like, and you know maybe a lot of them. So what do you think about their situation here?
Funny, you know, also over the last 25 years, it has changed. The populace of the immigration has changed. Iranians came also, you know, in the years before the Olympic Games. They all want to go forward, most of them. After 2009, again, there was a... Iranians are not that many. Mostly what came was also in the before the Olympic years, like in 2000. After 2004, a lot of Afghans came when they left Iran. All the Afghanic populace of Greece that was here as refugees and immigrants, they were not from Afghanistan, where we thought, you know, the war, mm-hmm. 2001, 2003, Iraq and everything, they didn't. Most of them came because of the racistic government in Iran. If you were Afghan, suddenly you could not go to school, you could not have a passport, you could not do anything anymore. That was around 2004. Suddenly all the Afghans who have an Iranian mother and a father Afghan, they had to leave because they could not work. Mm-hmm. You know this film, Baran? It tells a story like mm-hmm. that with this girl who works in a construction. Suddenly they all had to go because of this, you know, mm-hmm. Iran decided they have to go.
Even if you're half Iranian, half Afghan?
Yes, even if you were born there. Wow. So a lot of Afghans were in that time came actually not from Afghanistan but from Iran. Mm. They were all Iranian kids. They spoke like they're from Tehran, not like they're from Afghanistan, which is interesting. Now it has changed. Now most of the Afghan populace here is actually from Afghanistan. That's why I only understand 50% when they talk with me in Farsi.
Dari.
Yeah, they speak Dari and Pashto and everything. It's back then. They all were, you know, from Iran. Another thing is that Iranians mostly come to go forward here. They don't stay that much in Greece, most of them.
I'm interested in you as a person born of Iranian father and a Greek mother. You have this dual identity. How do you see it from this both Greek and Iranian perspective? What is happening here with the refugees? Like how the next governments, I'm not only talking about Nea Demokratia right now, but other governments on the way, were handling this situation with refugees?
Well, I think however they're handling it, even if they're handling it a little more liberal or more humane or whatever, it is mostly always programmed by, you know, Brussels.
Interesting.
By the European Union, of how they put their borders and everything. So it varies in little details. When Syriza came in 2015, just before, the year before, we had some drownings, you know, because it happens something, what they do. They want to take them out of the Greek. Mm-hmm. They put a line on the boat, and then the boat drops, and kids get drowned. That was how they... With Syriza, really what happened is anything that is on the street, on the sea, we get them. We take them with us. We let them in, or we save them. Because they wanted to do it differently, you know. Then we saw what happened in 2015, which was such a big crisis that, you know, they could not save everybody. So I think mostly that is a detail in handling it. If the European Union tells you, we give you a NATO-trained unit called Frontex to guard your borders, like if it is war, I think it speaks for itself, you know. We want to guard our borders from the invaders, for example. Mm-hmm. It was funny because in 2015, when you looked of how many refugees actually with the war since 2001 had come to Europe, I think of all Europe, if we say Europe is one, the European mm-hmm. Union, mm-hmm. there was one refugee, I think, to 1,000 people in all over Europe. One refugee to 1,000 people. In Lebanon, in Turkey, there is one every 15 people
mm-hmm. yeah.
from the camps, from the people that are taking refuge. Mm-hmm. Because when you leave your country, you don't say, oh, well, let's go to Sweden mm-hmm. yeah. to live mm-hmm. well. You go to the next village first, if your village is bombed. You go to the next big city. Then you start crossing the border. You stay close to the border so that you can come yeah. back in if everything goes all right. I think the last thing that dies is the hope.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody wants to actually be where they are from, you know. And then you go further and further away. And, you know, those people, the European Union, the Greek, also depending on the government each time, they call them invaders. I mean, now with the fires, those alt-right bastards in, you know, also the government, mm-hmm. sorry, they actually are claiming that those poor people set fire on the woods where they were hiding. I mean, that's what they said. They said, yeah, well, the fire was made by human hands. We have proof for that. And it is obvious that this fire started on routes that illegal immigrants mm-hmm. and refugees use. Who says something like that?
Well, somebody who can win some political thing.
Okay, okay. Every time the markets, every time the system is in trouble, what they feed you is nationalism, racism, bigotry, and everything.
And fear. So you can.
And fear. Yeah. And a fearful society. Very. Yeah, you're right. So, you know, that kind of, you know, can make you really mad. Mm-mm. Or what is. How this is being handled. That's why I think always, you know, we are made of the same stuff, all people, you know, of different colors. We have the same aspirations. We have the same dreams. You know, we have the same humanitarian heritage in ourselves.
Hmm. Interesting. To wrap it up a little bit, I would like to go back to Tehran show a little bit. You as a person who supports the movement for change in Iran and is vocal about this, how was it for you to play, to act as somebody who's on the other side, actually a pretty vicious character, a general who's one of the top villain in the whole show? How do you prepare for that as a person who's on the other side?
I think it's very interesting. First of all, I must say I love that. I love playing that. I also love playing things that are diametrically different than me. It's, you know, what you do in things like that, you play heroes. You play heroes as you know them from the comic books, as you know them from the cowboy movies, the old cowboy mm-hmm. movies, you know, the images that you have. You are part of one storytelling. So, you know, when I played, because in Tehran, well, actually more in another film, I play Soleimani's follower. I mean, really a vicious character. What they do now is to make it a little more delicate is that, okay, this guy, he's also charming. He loves his son. He, you know, they show facets mm-hmm. of his personal life to make it a little more delicate and a little more attractive or
human.
Whatever.
More human.
Humane.
Yeah. Mm. Yes, a little more humane. Mm. I don't believe that people are born monsters or racist or everything. It's part of a system that makes them act in a certain way. I mean, the actions of a person is what counts, what mm-hmm. makes him. So it is very interesting to play the villain, the bad guy. It is what you learn when you start your acting career in the school and everything, in acting school, and the way you also view stories, theater and films. I loved that character, not the person itself, but I loved playing him, you know. It felt very comfortable, telling that story. Actually, a little before that, and since then, I very often they take me to play, you know, the charming middle-aged bad guy that is, you know, you can love him and hate him for what he does. You know, it is a certain hero, a certain character that. So, I must say, it was a pleasure working on that. And with the people, the Israelis, crazy, loud like the Greeks. I mean, they say quiet on the set, and it doesn't get quiet. Yeah. Very temperamental, and also very emotional, very expressive, and everything. I love everything about it. This is why we say when we talk about these things, I have nothing against the Israelis. Yeah. They are temperamental people. I don't know. The women are beautiful. Whatever. It's a different thing that, you know, keeps us apart. It's not religion. It's not geographical. It's completely different.
It's politics, mostly.
Yes, it's politics. It is political interests of a small number of elite that makes that. I don't want to go into details and because it can become crazy. But politically, yeah, we have nothing to divide really between us.
Vasilis, thank you very much for this conversation. I bet you we could talk for hours. Yeah. But it's very hot in here.
Yes,
those lights.
Yes.
So at some point we have to finish our conversation. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for
sharing your personal stories and your views. I want to thank our team who made this podcast a live thing, both in audio version and visual version, because I want to remind everybody that now they can not only listen to us, but also see us, watch us on YouTube and on Spotify podcast. And one more thing that I would like to remind everybody and tell them, those who see us, that again, I'm wearing a t-shirt designed by our fantastic Eli Fazlolla. And those t-shirts can be bought at refocusmedialabs.org store. So we encourage everybody to go there, and all the earnings from this sale goes to the benefit of Refocus Media Labs to teach refugees based in Greece and Poland media skills so they can join the job market. Thank you very much for everybody.
One more time,
Fractured Podcast is produced by Refocus Media Labs, citizen journalists.
Thank you.
There are so many movies being shot in Greece that imitate certain, like, of course, Tehran, but like imitating Turkey.
What we do is very, very strong because young actors play the kids. So what happens there is actually the adult who is playing, who is in a situation of a kid, what he does is looking at the children in the audience and says, hey, I'm you. I'm representing you and everything. You have a lot of fun.
Yeah, we should go.
Yeah, we all definitely.
Yeah, I will.
We're gonna come.